Hey there, this is Scott Stratton, co-author of Unmarketing, Everything Has Changed and Nothing Is Different, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing. And don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Also, if you're listening to the show right now and you're not driving or operating dangerous machinery, please send me a tweet and tell me where in the world you're listening from. My Twitter handle is @marketingbook. And for this episode, use the hashtag Unbook, because today we're joined by Scott Stratton, and we're going to talk about the new second edition of the bestseller that he's co-authored with his wife, Allison, Unmarketing. Everything has changed and nothing is different. Scott Stratton is the president of Unmarketing. He's an expert in viral, social, and authentic marketing, which he calls Unmarketing. He was named one of the top five social media influencers in the world by Forbes and one of America's 10 marketing gurus by Business Review USA, which is particularly noteworthy because he's a Canadian. With his wife, Allison, he has written three other best-selling business books, The Book of Business Awesome, Unselling, and what, in my opinion, is the best marketing book title in the history of the printed word, QR Codes Kill Kittens, How to Alienate Customers, Dishearten Employees, and Drive Your Business into the Ground. Scott and Allison are also hosts of the Unpodcast, where they talk about the week's brand blunders and train wrecks, send climbers up Moron Mountain, and even share the occasional good story or two. Scott has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Huffington Post, USA Today, Entrepreneur Magazine, CNN, Inc.com, Fast Company, and even the Marketing Book Podcast. Scott, congratulations on the second edition of Unmarketing, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you for having me. We're actually way too excited for the second edition, mainly because people were still reading the first edition.
Yes.
And that's a cause for problem when it was written 6-7 years ago.
Right. Well, thank you for updating it.
You're welcome.
And I should say, Scott, this interview will probably not be 59 minutes in length, but can you explain the significance? Can you explain the significance of Scott Stratton, 59 minutes and podcast episode lengths?
So our first episode, so we've done 150 episodes of the Unpodcast, and you have to understand in context that I've never done something 150 weeks in a row in my life. And so it's quite an accomplishment for us to put this out that often. And the first episode we ever did, like we booked a studio and we have a film crew and an engineer, and we went all out for it. And you're putting yourself, as you know, you're putting yourself out there when you do a podcast. It's intimate with the listener. It's very kind of, it's you, it's your voices, it's your appearance. And it was Allison and I for the first episode, and the first ever comment we got for our show, the first listener feedback was 59 minutes, ? I haven't actually listened to the episode yet, but 59 minutes long? Come on. That was it. That was the feedback we got. And that becomes our recurring joke in the show, so much so that we formed a production company. We were making a documentary in the next year or so about the speaking world, about being nervous speaking, called Unspeakable. And we formed our company, our corporation, and we actually registered it with the government of Canada. It is called 59 Minute Films.
That's great. And so I guess everyone then is asking, oh, so you guys specialize in films that are 59 minutes. Interesting niche.
Yeah, it's going to be 90 minutes, by the way. It's
okay.
Going to throw everybody off.
Well, then you will need to re-register your company name. So let me start with just one quote from the book, and we'll go from there. And it's on at the very beginning, and you say, everything has changed. In 2009, we could complete a social media conversation by looking at Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We called into teleseminars, checked in on Foursquare, and seemed obsessed with everyone in every business being on social media. QR codes were found on stock boxes and inside toilet tanks, not websites, and we could write 40,000 words without the word app being one of them. Oreo had never dunked in the dark during the Super Bowl, and no one had ever dumped an ice bucket on their head, at least not for charity anyway. Our moms weren't on Facebook, and our kids weren't on Snapchat. But even though you say, Scott, everything has changed, you go on to say nothing has changed. Explain.
Well, that's the point. That's the point. It was so much so, we believed in this fact so much so that we changed the subtitle of Unmarketing, because the book, the best-selling one we've written, was Unmarketing, Stop Marketing, Start Engaging. And we actually, on the cover, it's actually scratched out. And it's that the new subtitle is Everything Has Changed and Nothing Is Different. And what the purpose of that and why that is now the theme is people, I really believe people, for the most part, don't have to be convinced about the existence of engagement or social media anymore, and the existence of new things. The problem is that they've become overwhelming now. The problem is now we have a world of people out there saying you've got to be on these 17 different platforms, and you've got to be here and here and here. And we've forgotten kind of the base of business. We've forgotten that it's the basics that still matter. I don't care how good of an Instagram your brand has if you can't return my call in customer service within a reasonable amount of time. So we've forgotten these things. I don't want you to be great at Snapchat and terrible at service or at the product or anything else. So really, if you want to decipher it, it's really what it says is just calm down. Just calm down.
Great advice. Everybody
needs to calm down for a second. Let's just relax and step back. And that's a great contrast to what the original one was written, which was, here we have a new world here. Let's see what we can do with it. And now it's like, just simmer down. Just look at this and say, okay, we know people are here. We know every week a new platform's coming up. We know that now, you know, today, as of recording this, like live video is the now the new thing, where a month ago or 2 months ago, it was 360 video or 360 photos. And before that, it was going to be, augmented and virtual reality. Where's that going to go? And everybody's, 7 months ago was Pokemon Go. Like, so these, it's like a Jack Russell Terrier just jumping up and down and up and down. And that's not the way to market. I don't think marketing should be a reactive based thing. I think marketing should be strategic. And if we look at things and say, where do we want to go? What is our goal to accomplish? And who are we trying to get that to? Then we can look at these channels and say, do any of these suit our needs? Not reverse, meaning, all right, we want to do a virtual reality. How do we squeeze that into our columns?
Yeah, like we got to have an app.
Yeah, wait. Tell me, that's not the one sentence that really sums everything up, right? We need an app, and you look at them and go, okay, why? Well, because they have one, and nobody needs another app. We need useful apps. I do find it fascinating that what we're in this day and age, and I find it exciting, but it's also ripe for the picking when it comes to being taken advantage of or going the wrong way and wasting time and money, which marketing is very good at doing. Is that where do we have this world of not just smartphones? We don't need to tell people that the world is run by phones, but we do still, because there's still a lot of brands out there that have websites that don't render properly on phones. Like, so part of, I have like one foot in the future saying, relax, this is where we're going. And my other foot is like, can we be better at 2002? Can we work on 2002 for a bit? Because we're still not there with half the brands. Like, we look at the brands that are front facing and tech savvy. I hop onto my Delta app when I'm flying, and I can rebook a flight within 3 seconds of it being delayed in two clicks on my app, and I'm done and I'm good to go, and I have to do nothing else. I go on Starbucks app, and I can be in Frankfurt, Germany, and use the same card I use in Toronto as I use in Manhattan, and it's all synced and all perfect and it's seamless, which is what an app should do. It should enhance the user experience. That's one foot. The other foot is still seeing, still seeing websites that have animated GIFs in them, or just don't, you can't even use a form properly because they don't run on a phone, because they've been built for the olden days. So that's my struggle. Is one side, I look at somebody and like, they're like, we want to do some live video for a Facebook page. And I'm like, I can't even use your site properly.
Yeah. You talk about the live video out there these days, and it was actually, interesting. I think it's probably a brand new chapter.
Yeah.
And you talk about how the problem is that with a lot of people using live video is to show that they're doing it, or because they've been told to do it. Why are both really bad reasons?
I don't think mandatory content is ever a good thing. I don't think doing something because you're supposed to. We're not children right now. We're not being told what we're supposed to do. And especially, this is the problem. Live video out of any piece of content out there in the history of content is the most unforgiving and the hardest to do. I really believe that. That I think just take away the live for a second. Just do, let's talk video first, then I'm going to layer on the live. Video itself is extremely hard to do well. I think 85% of the world is unfilmable. Unfilmable. For the majority of the world, mainly because they don't want to be on camera. And the other part of that is just some people are just naturally awkward, and it actually hurts your brand when you can see something like that. So I think the majority of the world is honestly unfilmable. Throw in then live video without the ability to edit, without the ability to reshoot, retake, clip it, take away some you know, filler in there, then it's even worse. Then throw in the layered thumbs up flying across the screen, the hearts flying across the screen, a troll saying some phallic word, and you're just watching it. It's just like this ADD nightmare of content. And at the end of the day, I think this is the most important part, which is we call it contextual content, which means, does the content you're putting out match the platform you're using? So if you're doing a live video, does the content need to be live?
Great question.
So does it, right? Is that the point where if you're saying, look, we're just going to talk about our newest release of a product, and I'm fine with you doing that on video. I have no problem with you, you know, pitching something to your people. But does live make sense? Because that means you have people flying and scrolling and questions. And if you're not willing to interact with the audience, you lose part of the point of live. I'd rather you film it with one camera, two camera, three camera, and edit and make it done really well versus live. The problem is live has this thing where it's the EdgeRank algorithm on Facebook that says, if you do live right to our page, we're going to give you a bonus. You know, we're going to push it into everybody's feed more. And that shouldn't be the incentive. It should be quality content. Now, here's the difference where I was complaining to Allison about live video a few months ago, and we're in our home office, which is our bedroom, just sitting up, and I'm on my laptop, and I'm complaining about this live video stuff to her. Meanwhile, while I'm complaining, I'm streaming through Facebook Live the Prophets of Rage concert in Toronto. So I'm watching a concert on the laptop through Facebook Live while complaining about live video. There's your contradiction, because it made sense. It made contextual content sense. Concert was in my town. I wanted to go to it. I couldn't go to it. So I was streaming it because it made sense to stream it because it was happening live. So if it's that type of thing, if it's like the it's the Grammys, if they decided to put it on, that makes sense streaming live. You know, it's a sporting event. It's backstage before you go on to a show streaming live. If the time makes sense, it makes sense to be in real time, then maybe. The problem is, this is why Blab shut down. This is why part of Vine, you know, stopped going. This is why Google Hangouts were shutting down, because the founder of Blab said this pretty much verbatim. You're not that interesting. That's what he said. That was the line. It was, we're not that interesting. And that's true. We're not that interesting to have a live streaming video of us at any time. Where live video works, and where this is where Blab is going with theirs, is that it's not streaming live multiple people. I always found Blab was ridiculous. It was three or four heads. It was like the Brady Bunch of morons. It was just these three, four heads and different qualities of microphones and streaming. And I really believe that some of the most important parts of video is audio. If it doesn't sound well, it won't look well. It doesn't happen that way. So we never had that working. Where the advantage and where the point of that type of multiple head type of thing, and Blab came out and said this, was people were using it to talk to each other. So we're having like video parties together, not public. And you notice this is where a lot of the apps and technology shifts are going. Snapchat works well, not because of the stories, not the public stories, but the snaps back and forth privately to each other. That's what works. That's why House Party is a big app right now, which is simply Blab privately. It's just video between each other. That's where it's working. And that's, we again call that, it's a bad name for it, but it's stuck. It's dark social, which is, it's not public. And that's where the advantage of that goes. So I don't think we should be chasing that thing. And we've seen, you and I both have seen this, where when Facebook gave a benefit to photos in the timeline, every brand started putting photos up and they put up their brand messages. Then Facebook's like, all right, simmer down. Now you can't do photos with too much text. More than 30% text, you're out. So they started shrinking the text on their photos. I'm like, that's not the point. That's not what we're here for. We create content because it matches the context of what we're trying to get across.
Yeah, it's funny how Gary Vaynerchuk often talks about the expression "marketers ruin everything."
Everything.
And his point is just try to be the first one to ruin it, so you can get the arbitrage of the attention before you have to move on to the next thing.
Exactly.
So unmarketing. Let's talk about the heart of unmarketing, and what does that have to do with a guy named Wes who works at the Wynn Casino in Las Vegas?
Unmarketing, from its core, from anywhere from 15 years ago when I started the company as a consulting to today, from the original hardcover book to the paperback to the new edition, has always been about your people are your marketers. And I don't mean the marketing people. I say this with the most love I can for my industry, that we're not the marketers. We're the formal marketers. We're the push marketers. But the story marketers, the ones that really create the stories that last, that get told and retold, are the people, especially the front lines. And that's where the Wes story happens. That's why we kept it in the book for the newest edition. Was Wes is a was just a cleaner at the Wynn Casino, you know, multi-billion-dollar casino in Vegas, one of our favorite places to go. And Wes's story still holds true today. You walk in a side entrance. I've never been to the Wynn at this time. We walked in and we turn around and he's cleaning the floor and he stops the floor cleaner because we were really early. And in Vegas, you don't want to be walking around Vegas at 8 a.m. It's a weird place to be. So he
I'll
shuts
take your
off.
Word for it.
Yeah. He shuts. There's two types of people up at that time. There's the runners who are running in the morning. You got to avoid them. And there's people returning from a night out. You really want to avoid them. Okay. So you walk into the Wynn. And because I'm going for an event, and he turns off his giant floor cleaner, and I want to get out of the way, and he's like, "Sir, no, I'll move for you." And he looks at me, and he's like, "How you doing today?" And he looks me right in the eye, and I'm like, "Whoa!" Like, I'm not used to this. I'm not used to somebody like I'm used to being inconveniencing somebody. I'm used to being a consumer that feels like I'm interrupting employees. Mm-hmm. You know that feeling?
Yeah.
Right. You're always like, you feel like they're saying to themselves, if it wasn't for customers, our day would be so much easier. Like, that's what they're feeling from these employees. Well, Wes was different. And I walked in, he looked me right in the eye and he's like, "Sir, whatever you're here for today, you know, I wish I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm like, I wish you have a wonderful day." He looks at me with this look of like, he really damn well means it, that he is honored that I've come to the Wynn today. And I'm like, what? And that was my first impression of this billion-dollar casino, was the guy cleaning the floor. And he set the tone for me. And now I walk into the rest of the casino with a different attitude or a different impression than I could have just been kind of complacent with it. Because you get overwhelmed by that stuff in Vegas. And I wrote about it. And I wrote a blog post about Wes. This guy, this is the billion-dollar brand. It was him who started it for me. And we wrote a post and it went bananas. And he ended up winning Employee of the Year.
Excellent.
But it wasn't just because of us dealing with, but he was like that to everybody. And that's the key. I really believe that the best marketing we can do is hire well and hire good people. And I think when you look at if I ask somebody to pick a legacy brand that's known for being great, it's because they have great people. You know, talk about Zappos, talk about Ritz-Carlton, talk about Disney. All those places invest in their people, in the hiring of their people and the training of their people. So much so that all three of those have their own training programs that other companies can do because it's that good. You don't think that's a coincidence that they find great people and keep great people? And I really think HR is part of marketing that way. And I think the stories we tell as consumers are the stories of our interaction with the humans.
I should remind the listener that you have a background in human resources. And also, what you're talking about is the subject of several other books that have been on the show about the whole customer experience and why that is so important for marketing. And it really has to be consciously engineered. Wes being there greeting you, that was not a mistake.
No, it was trained that way. This is because I think somebody had to tell him somewhere along the line by saying is that you are our ambassador. You are the ambassador to, and every person in there is the ambassador to our brand. And you have to empower them to be able, they have to feel good about their job too. Otherwise, if you're getting browbeaten at work and your manager's a jerk, it's really hard to be wonderful to the customer. I think pressure is top-down driven. It's pushed that way. And I think that it really comes out of the bottom. And the front line are usually the least appreciated and least paid. And that's a bad combination for the front. I'm heading after we do this interview today, I'm going to be heading to do a gig tomorrow up north from where I am for a certain restaurant brand. And you're looking at them and their reviews are coming out and they're getting a lot of bad reviews. And who do you think the reviews are from? They're from the front lines. They're from the bad service, the bad people. And they've just done a whole rebrand of their company. And I'm like, well, the rebrand, rebrand the people. You know what I mean? Either find better frontline or find better managers to empower those frontlines to do a better job.
So, Scott, you explained that for generations, marketing has been hypocritical. Mm-hmm. Why do marketers, I guess I should ask you to explain that.
Sure.
And then explain why marketers still keep trying the same stale marketing moves.
Well, that was the original push of the entire word on marketing for me was people hate being cold called, but then they turn around and do it themselves. That's how unmarketing started, was in a friend's office when we both had a job. And I was in a friend's office and we were chatting about whatever and the phone rang and it was somebody cold calling him and he berated the guy on the phone, berated him. I felt bad for him. And then he hung up the phone. He's like, okay, Scott, good seeing you, man. You got to go though. I got to go do my calls for the day. And I'm like, you just totally ripped a guy a new one about cold calling, but you're doing it. And then he said what made me realize why we do it. He looks at me and goes, yeah, but I sell something people need. I'm like, there we go. You know, it's like that psychology play of this. I justify it myself because I'm not like that person. And I realize that that's what we're doing. You know, we don't want to get spam, but we're wondering how much does it cost if our business does it. We don't want more junk mail in our mailbox, but we're like, that's a good rate. I could do 1,000 for $200. Not bad. You know, and so it's also a lot of times old kind of hypocritical marketing is also lazy marketing. You know, it's easier, it's cost effective. And, you know, spam is actually a really good return if you look at the amount of email you send and what you get back. Like if you do the math, I don't want to do it. I don't want to be. It's also breaking the law. But, you know, if you want to look at ROI, it's not too shabby. I just ask the Viagra people. It's not too bad at all. You know, it can work. And that's the problem is not just can it work, but does it make sense for our brand and our the story we want to tell? Because we do it now. And this is how we actually updated the book to reflect this, that I finally admitted that knocking on my front door to sell me something can work. Here's the thing. Like, this is a big admission for me. Like, I was in confession for this because I'm the unmarketing guy. I am no cold call, no advertising, no this, just, it, you know, community and connection. And then, you know, somebody knocks on my door and says, hey, we're doing your neighbor's driveway. We're repaving their driveway. And if, did you need yours done? If so, we'll give you a great discount. We're bringing the equipment in. Plus, we're giving your neighbor a discount if you sign up. I'm like, and I, by the way, I didn't get it paved, but I wasn't upset. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that actually made sense. I'm like, okay, so door knocking makes sense. Another guy came the next day to my door and he's like, we're from a local farm and we do a kind of a meat cooperative. And I'm like, you're coming to my door to sell meat? I'm like, keep going, keep talking, go on. And he's like, we do this. We actually, you get a quarter of a cow and this type of stuff. He's like, you know, people buy kind of steak in bulk. And he's like, you buy this much, we give you a freezer. I'm like, go on. And so we kept talking and we had a sample and we had another meeting. So I'm like, I can't stand here on my mountaintop and say, you can't do this. But the content was contextual. It made sense. But a week later, you know, since I'm at home, I don't work for a living anymore. I speak at conferences. So when I'm at home and I'm not wearing pants half the time. So the door.
The listener should understand that you work very hard at that.
I do very hard at that. I'm wearing pants right now. So even though this is audio.
I'm talking about speaking, Scott. Come on.
Yeah, but sorry.
And it didn't happen overnight either.
No, it did not. But my doorbell rang and I'm in my robe, my Caesar's Palace robe. I told you we like Vegas.
So sort of the Hugh Hefner look.
Oh, yeah, except Hugh Hefner, if he was from Metallica. So, you know, the hair is flying, my tattoos, my beard, and I open the door, and this guy in a suit just like, hey, sir, I'm in the neighborhood, and looks up and goes, oh. And I'm like, what do you want? He's like, I opened up a financial planning office up the street, and we're wondering, I'm like, are you at my door? I'm ringing my doorbell, asking me to reveal my finances to you. He's like, well, I'm just wondering if you're getting a return on. I'm like, why would I answer any of these questions? I close the door. I realize the bigger the trust gap with somebody, the more trust you have to earn, the worse it is doing cold calls. Because when they knock on the door, when you call somebody, when you blind email somebody or do anything cold, you're at the lowest place of authority. You have the least leverage and the most price sensitivity. So it made sense for the pavers. It made sense for the meat people, but not the financial planner. So we have to, it has to be graded. But things like that, though, direct mail still works. Addressed direct mail. I don't believe in unaddressed, kind of the blanket junk mail. But addressed mail works more today than I think it's worked in years because less people are doing it.
Yeah.
So I just think that at the end of the day, I want to go to bed knowing that I didn't market the way I hate to be marketed to. That's hypocritical marketing. That's where we do the way we hate. So I don't want to phone somebody at dinner time and try to pitch them something on the phone. I don't want to add to the clutter in their inbox or their mailbox. But I do want to give them the content that they find relevant and contextual then.
Right. And there's one visual in the book that I want to talk about and try and describe the picture for the listener who's probably driving right now. Keep your eyes on the road. And I'm going to have a picture of this in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And it's the hierarchy of buying. And it's central to several of the things you talk about in the book. So I want you to envision, listener, there's a triangle with one of the points up at the top. And so going up the left side of the triangle is the word trust. So the more trust you have, you go further up the triangle. And on the right side, the right part of the triangle has the word relationship. So you have a better relationship the further up the triangle you go. And so the bottom, and it's got six different levels on the triangle. So at the bottom, there's cold calling. Okay. So that's way down there with lower trust and lower relationship. And then there's, you know, searching through ads like Yellow Pages, search engines. And then the third one is a recognized expert in the field. And then the fourth one is a current relationship, but you haven't yet purchased. And then the next to last one towards the very top is referral by a trusted source. And then the top of the heap, the top of the triangle, where the most trust and the best relationship is the current satisfied customer. So, Scott, why do so many companies start at the bottom of that triangle, like where there's cold calling and irritating customers, instead of becoming more of a recognized expert?
And that's where I want people to aim. That's why we did the hierarchy in the first place, was I want you to start all of your marketing at the middle of that. Because the bottom, and in the triangle itself, there's two shades of blue, yourself and the competition. And the more dark blue, the more competitors you're dealing with. And I just don't want to start with the lowest leverage. Now, I blame Drake mostly for this, from when his song started from the start at the bottom. People want to, you know, they want to have that struggle. But in all seriousness, the middle is where you want to go, because I think we can form. That's where content marketing comes into play. That's the entire thing of content marketing, allows you to skip the first few levels. Now, I know search can do great. I know search getting your people looking for you, looking for exact thing. But again, if I'm searching, I don't know you. A lot of times I have a huge level of price sensitivity, and that becomes an issue. I want us to aim to position. I want us to aim to be known as the person. This works for realtors and lawyers and financial advisors, to people who sell garage doors. It doesn't matter, where we're just positioning ourselves as the people who know what they're doing. And we just had that with our just think about for a second, who, you know, look about your, especially service providers in business. You know, how did you find your accountant, your lawyer, a financial planner, a mortgage person? And you look and you realize a lot of them are connected. You know, this brief, we found it because of a referral from this one. So your job is not only creating content to be a recognized expert, but then I want to go up the next level and realize, who are the exponential referrers in your world, in your community? Who's the one, who's the accountants, who's the, or the lawyers or the financial planners or the insurance salespeople? Who are the people that have been connected? If you have especially a regional business that benefits from getting known better in your community, you want to connect with those people. Those are the ones who can exponentially refer you to others. I'd rather find the one person that can refer me to 10 people than try to go find those 10 people myself. It's a lot of work, because then they lend their trust to you. They lend their position on that hierarchy to you. Now, it makes it more important, even more so than any time, to make sure you do a good job, because they are loaning that credibility.
So when it comes to companies that should and can go into this area, they don't think of themselves as experts. Why are they so reluctant to consider themselves experts?
It's a funny thing. You know, it's a funny, it's like there's a contrast. There's two groups of people, ones who think they're experts and aren't a lot of times, and the other right. ones, the other ones who don't think they are because they're not. And there's a difference. And this has been a core message through the whole time for us, which is there's a difference between calling yourself an expert and the expert. You know, one is an admission of your knowledge, and the other one is you're kind of bragging of a position. And an expert simply is somebody who knows more about a subject than the common person. And the problem is we're waiting for you know, that certificate to come in the mail saying you're now a marketing expert. You know, I became a marketing expert when I said I was one. You know, that's really it's a tough thing where we're all experts in something, and I just want, you know, what that topic that you're good at, that you're passionate at. It can be anything from you're an expert in tennis to plumbing to marketing to accounting, whatever that is. But and saying you're the expert gives the confidence, you know, it's saying I know what I'm doing. And the problem is if you don't know what you're doing, you don't exude confidence in your potential customers. And I find this a lot when it comes to creating content. People will say, just write, just record a podcast. Just go ahead and do it and try it and you'll get better. And I'm like, whoa, hang on a second. Our content should not be a training bra. It should not be, let's just give it a shot here. I want to make sure that I don't want perfection in content, but I want it to represent our business in the best way possible. So instead of just writing or recording potential gibberish, I want us to research. I want us to find out what makes good shows. Practice privately. Get some stuff out there. And then once you've gone through the motions, then you don't have a second chance to make that brand impression. So if you have a show and it's staticky and it's not recorded well and it's all over the place, now mind you, our show is on podcasts is all over the place, but that's another argument another day.
Well, but it's extremely well produced.
Thank you. That's what matters really at the end of the day. As long as it sounds and looks good, it doesn't matter. But I just don't want us making content for content's sake. And I've always been that way. Mm-hmm. From the first book, from the first post I wrote, I've always not created stuff for the sake of creating it. And I wish people would look at that way as well. Nobody's sitting around waiting for your weekly newsletter. You know, if you put it out consistently, if you can find that apex of frequency and quality of content, then perfect. But otherwise, let's just give it a rest.
So, Scott, in the book, you talk about the seven deadly social media sins. And can you talk about some of them, particularly the ones that make a special vein in your forehead appear when they occur?
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing that they've always been consistent from the first writing of the book till now. They shifted a bit, you know, of where they go. But, you pick anything. It's the greed and the gluttony. I'm actually going to open the chapter. I want to pick one out for specific. Do you have which chapter number? Where is it? Hang on a second.
Let's see here.
I'll find it. There it is, 19. I don't want to. I start to mix them up sometimes. I got them here. Okay. Yeah. So I start mixing them up, and then I sound like a goof because, gluttony still kills me, by the way. I mean, it still happens today. You know, it's like I need – but it's just shifted platforms. So it used to be gluttony was I need to get followers as fast as I can. We'll do these massive auto-follows to hope everybody gets some following back, and then you dump them the next day who doesn't follow you back, and you rinse and repeat. And that's happening now. The gluttony is happening more now, and that actually goes into the whole thing of which is not one, but it's pride or vanity though, which is
pride,
more
pride
like –
pride is one of them.
Pride is one of them, but it's not the same definition of the pride. I'm happy. As I said in that chapter, screw it. You can be proud of something.
Yeah, like when my kids do something fantastic.
Of course.
Yeah.
Then go nuts. But it's the vanity that causes it. So the you get this vanity side when you're dealing with gluttony, which is the more likes we get, the better we are. The more hearts we get, the better we are. The more favorites, the more shares, the more retweets. And then when we have that number, that vanity metric as our driver, it opens up the world for it to be taken advantage of, for it to be doctored, for it to be kind of exponentially done. And then it just ruins. It's a vanity metric. That's really what it comes down to for me. So but they all still play. Sloth still plays. You know, we have people who will answer their Facebook message as a brand in 2 weeks when the expectation of response is 3 minutes. And, you know, I will still call. I still rather you close your account down than be that slow on it. But they all still play. I'm just loving this. I'm looking back at it again.
Hey, you know, one of them you talk about is envy, and you mentioned a concept that was new to me called freebooting. Can you explain what that is and why that's so pernicious?
Oh, freebooting. Okay. So freebooting is what – now you're getting the vein pop in my head. So freebooting is the term was created because of video, but it applies to most any content where people will take – so Facebook – like we said before, Facebook gave favor in their EdgeRank algorithm to Facebook video. Now, this wasn't not live video, just Facebook video. And if you uploaded video natively to Facebook, so with up in their own system onto your page, you could be a personal page, but this is more about brand pages. If you uploaded it there, it would give an EdgeRank algorithm boost. So it'll be exposed to more people. So what people were doing and brands were doing, a lot of radio station Facebook pages, they're always the ones doing this stuff. They'd go to YouTube. They'd rip off the source file. I mean, there's a bunch of sites that'll do it for you. They downloaded the video file from they'd find the proven viral successes from YouTube, download them, and upload them to their Facebook page, and which would then make them the source of the video.
To Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they'd get millions upon millions of views of that video because it's already been proven viral on YouTube. And so it'd be like, and of course, it's Tyrese is my arch nemesis here, who's the famous actor and Fast and Furious guy and model who uploads all these videos. I'm sure it's not him ripping them off potentially, but it's a person running his page. But like one of the videos he shared had like a America's Funniest Video. It was watermark in the bottom corner of it, but that wouldn't stop him. And people would look at me and they're like, well, who cares? Who cares if Tyrese rips something off? And I'm like, well, in the video underneath it, there's no link to the original one. There's no link to the content creator. And in it, he's like, my new mixtape drops next week. So he's leveraging the video viralness that has nothing to do with his mixtape, by the way. And to get it out there. And people are like, well, why do you care? I'm like, I care about ethics. I care about attributing the original content creators. I care about copyright. I think, and if we don't care about it as marketers, who does? Like nobody does. And I just think it's for what? For what? A vanity metric? A couple of untargeted likes to your brand page? But we've set up an ecosystem where our bosses or our clients want the vanity metric. I don't want a vanity metric. I want a real metric. I want a business metric that moves the needle. But you know, you realize we've been having the same conversation since the late 2000s about metrics and social media and what matters and what doesn't. We're still having the same damn conversation now, but it's worse. It's exponentially worse now because we're driving these things and we're making business decisions based on metrics that mean nothing to our business. I want the right metrics. Here's the needle we're trying to move. Let's see if it moves. And you know what? I probably sound tired because I'm tired. And if your boss says, I want a million views of a video, then fine, go get a million views. But you got to go to bed at the end of the night knowing you did that. You know what I mean? Like it just, because at the end of the quarter in the year, when you have no more revenue than you had before, or no more some signups or no more actual metrics, eventually the gig is up. Eventually, it's going to say, we didn't actually do anything, did we? But we had a lot of vanity metrics.
Yeah, and I think that marketers need to think about that. If they're working for an organization or if they're in an agency and they're serving clients, and the client's asking for that, pretty soon, like you said, the gig is up because they're going to say, wait a minute, you didn't help grow our business. You didn't generate leads or aware, or whatever you're trying to measure. And they're going to say, yeah, but that's what you wanted us to do. Well, I don't care. it didn't work. So at some point, even though they're asking for that, you as a marketer need to be saying, wait a minute, am I having any impact on this, the R word, revenue or sales, right, or something like that?
Because that's the problem is you realize a lot of these platforms aren't built for that direct result. Like Instagram, you know, you can't click on a link in a description of a photo on Instagram. So you get the look and the like, but it doesn't do much. Snapchat, there's not much I can do with it except get somebody to see it. You can't share anything on there. You can't like anything on there. So we have a metric of views, but heck, I can get you metrics on banner views. That's the worst thing in history. So sometimes if you want to move that needle, it's not the sexiest marketing. If you want to move that needle, maybe it's going to be an ad spend on Facebook. It's going to be an ad spend on with AdWords. Maybe it's going to be just the uncoolest stuff ever. But you know what? It's going to bring us more business. That's the point. And that's why it's so frustrating. I think that's why partially is that everything has changed and nothing is different. I want us to move the right metrics. And the problem is all these bells and whistles, all these noises. And by the way, some of them are a lot of fun. And you want to do them for fun? Awesome. But if we're talking business, then we need to talk. We need to get down to the right things.
Yeah, and there was a study by the Fornes Group a couple of years ago that keeps coming up where it was something like 80% of CEOs don't trust their chief marketing officers or their marketing people. Well, why is that? And it goes on to explain that it's because they don't understand how the company's making money, how sales are happening, and they're not directing their efforts toward that. So it's really astounding. But let's move on to one other topic that's near and dear to a lot of marketers and businesses, and that's websites. Mm-hmm. So in this second edition, you talked about the chapter on websites. You talk about how you hoped that when you wrote this book years ago that you wouldn't actually have to include this in the future. But it's almost an identical chapter. What are companies still doing wrong with their websites?
We really meant that when we wrote that. We just wish part of us wishes we don't have to keep saying these things. But the other half is like, it keeps me in business. So maybe don't do it right.
Yeah, it's kind of like the comedian who's tapping the microphone saying, hello, is this on?
Yeah. But please don't leave the room because I like the business. So it's just like, it's a combination of it where if common sense was common, we'd have no book, we'd have no business. But websites, I meant what I said before is that we have to get better at 2004. We have to go back and say they're not rendering properly on phones. We have this very self-centered type of thing where if they work well on my desktop, if that's where I'm looking at our site, then that's fine. Now, testing it on multiple screens, multiple operating systems. How many people listening right now have signed up for their own newsletter? Most haven't. Most don't realize that it's broken or it's too many hoops to jump through. You don't need 17 fields for me to sign in for your newsletter. You need one.
Or the double opt-in like you talk about.
Yeah. You need my email. That's all you need. You just need one
Maybe
thing.
My first name if you want to be friendly.
Oh, well, but this is what frustrates me. So I go to a site and I read their content, and I don't want to name the site, but it's DigiDay. And I went to their site and I read some great stuff. And they started bringing me into their enticing content funnel, which is their content site. So I read something because it was a referral from a trusted source of content. Somebody else shared it. So I went and read it. I'm like, this is really good. I actually like this site. I would like to sign up for their newsletter. Like that's what I literally said in my head. And there was a little thing at the bottom of my phone. It said sign up for newsletter. I'm like, sweet. So I click on sign up and it just had one little field, email. I'm like, oh, brilliant. They're even part of my crew here that they know that's all I need. And I put my email in, I click sign up, and it brought me to a new page and said, fill out these other 11 fields and we'll sign you up.
Your horoscope sign.
Yeah, everything. And so what happened? I didn't sign up. Even though they had my email address, they could have said, you're already signed up. Can you give us some more information so we can match our demographic to you? What they're just looking for the data for their advertisers. But so I ended up not signing up. And I'm sure I've missed hundreds and hundreds of posts and page views from DigiDay. And being a quote influencer, somebody who spreads content, they lost me on that. Like, that's what's frustrating to me. The ordering process is a pain in the ass, most sites. The way they render, how crowded a mobile page can be with your sidebars and your pop unders and all these type of things. Like just read it once yourself and see how much fun you have on your own site. It doesn't happen very well. Contact forms. Google coming this January is going to be, you know, banishing to the corner any sites that have pop-ups. Like people don't realize these, you know, sign up for our newsletter, the pop-up that comes up instantly. Google's just going to push you down to the results. So if you rely anything off organic search, it's not going to happen. The only pop-ups that will be allowed will be an age verification pop-up, a cookie verification pop-up like they have in the EU, and a very small pop at the bottom. So you're like just checking those things is making sure that you're still getting the results you want. But you know what? I could have said almost those exact things 7 years ago. There's still the same problem.
Yeah.
Still happening.
You know, it's like if you are giving your website visitor in what other format, you know, a tablet or a phone or a website, if you're giving them any kind of bad experience, ultimately you're going to get penalized by Google. They may not have figured out yet how to do that, but they're making enormous strides, like penalizing sites that have these pop-ups. It's just not working very well on the mobile, and they're, you know, or like people that don't have responsive design sites.
Yeah, the internet, the internet works off of relevance. That's the key. Like at the end of the day, if we write another book, it's going to be the title. It's just, it's relevance is everything. So that's why Facebook's newsfeed feeds you by relevance, not by time. That's why Instagram has changed to relevance, not time, because it's not recency. Recency is only a factor of relevance. That relevance is that when Google has made a living, has worth billions because of relevance. So Google has made their entire mission to know that when you search a term, whatever comes up at the top is the most relevant result possible. And if your site's one that comes up on the top and somebody clicks on it and it gets bombarded with a pop-up or it's deceiving or something happens and it's the, you know, great kind of click bait and switch type of move, then you're gone because they make their living off of relevance. And I think we should too.
Yeah. And that kind of leads us into what I want. The last question I wanted to ask you about the book that I think is really important for the listeners. That's the experience gap. Can you explain that concept?
It's the biggest, it's the gap between your best and worst experience with a brand. Now that can be content, that can be as a customer, but the bigger the gap, the bigger the chance that you can walk through and go to the competition. So you look at something like you go get coffee somewhere locally and it's always great. There's no gap. It's always great. There's no hole. There's no gap at all. But what happens if you go and every other time you go, it's wrong? It's a wrong order. And I know there's not much things you can screw up worse in this world than somebody's coffee in the morning, because especially if they do a drive-through and they're gone, they can't fix it. So you got that gap. And then maybe once the lid doesn't go on properly and you spill it. And then once the price goes up and you didn't realize it, then it just keeps going. And then the person at the drive-through window has an attitude. Well, you've opened up this gap for a competitor to show up. And the example in the book we use is Tim Hortons here in Canada. It's like religion here. And McDonald's came out with it. I used to work at McDonald's. My first job was working at McDonald's when I was 14. And they weren't known for their coffee. That's for sure. You know, it was known
you
as
said the, at that time it was what senior citizens had citizens. At 6 a.m.
At 6 a.m. senior citizens and want their free refill. That's what it was. That was their market. And McDonald's came out with McCafe and said, you know, we want to make a dent. And everybody's like, good luck. Good luck. And then so it turned out that they had better lids and better, you know, thumb to open up the when you're driving. That's one-handed. The cups were insulated. So the Tim Hortons cups here were not. They were the last company that gets sleeves for coffee. Their lids were a pain. They wouldn't take debit card, where the only time I had to take cash out. My joke was I always had to take the only people I had to take cash out for in life was Tim Hortons and a drug dealer. And my drug dealer took checks. Like that was like the joke was it the only business in history that still made you pay cash. But McDonald's had debit. They had locations. They had drive-thrus. And they had great coffee. And I would never have tried it if there was no gap from Tim Hortons, because we don't like change. Humans don't like change. But if you give us enough reason to change, we'll look for somebody else. And now, what you saw in the updated chapter, now I'm on to Starbucks.
Right, right. But it's a great example of where they don't engineer the great experience. You're opening up that gap, and your competitor is going to shoot that gap
right through. And the bigger it is, the better the opportunity. And sometimes that gap has to be extremely large for extremely high trust situations. So it could be a bank, you know, who you bank with, who your insurance is with. Changing your phone company is a big pain. So, you know, it's not as easy as switching over where you're going to have a croissant sometimes, but it can work. The bigger that gap, the bigger the chance people will eventually change.
So, Scott, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you and Allison hope it would be?
Focus, focus, focus. Focus on something and then do it well. Just this scattered world of content and social and digital has made us lose the art form of focus in marketing. And strategy and all that part of it is following it through. Do your homework and then go to it and do it and don't get distracted, because this is a world of distraction now. The age of disruption to me is the age of distraction. It's so much happening. And that's our job, is to create clarity in this disruption and say, this is what we do and we do it well.
Well said. And I've also heard a certain type of marketing is check the box marketing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some company out there selling locomotives or jet engines, and the CEO saying, hey, do we have a Snapchat strategy?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Check it. Yeah. Some guy's reading. I just saw it on the internet tubes.
I heard about Snapchat? It from my kids.
Yeah. My kids said, I got to be on the ChapSnat. And it's like, no, I don't want to.
Yeah.
No.
So are there any recent or upcoming books you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Ooh. That's a good question. I got a whole wall of books I want to read behind me. I'm going to turn around and actually look right here. Ooh, I loved Bayer's, Jay Bayer's Hug Your Haters. That was a great book.
Yeah.
Great proprietary new research done on that type of stuff. The research we really needed. So I was really impressed by that. I have a case of our book. Look at that. By the way, the coolest thing as an author is when people send you your translated book. It's wicked. Yes. We got a bunch of our translated copies here. And the great thing is, like, I don't know what they're saying about us, but it looks good to me. So I like the way it looks. So I would certainly push Jay's book because it's I just got my signed copy of one of the classic books, by the way, is Love is the Killer App by Tim Sanders, who's now awesomely enough for me as a friend of mine, which I never thought would be that way. One of my favorite books of all time. So we just had dinner in Vegas. So he gave me a signed copy. So I'm pretty giddy about that.
Oh, that's right. He lives there, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does now. Yeah.
Yeah. I met him last summer and he's going to be on the show for his new book, Deal Storming.
Deal Storming. Yeah. That's also a good one too. Yeah. So tell him I say hi.
Okay.
Big fanboy and now a friend, which is that's the coolest part, really, to be honest with you. You know, if we're on a book podcast, is that as an author, when I go to a bookstore and I walk up to the business bookshelf, I know half those people and a portion of those are friends of mine. That's the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, even for me, just having spoken to a number of them, it's you know, I'm a book nerd. I'll be the first to admit. And what I'll do, though, and this applies to you too, Scott, when I go to a bookstore and I see one of the books that has been on the show, there is unlimited lifetime point of purchase support. I pull the book out and leave it facing. I do that at all the airport bookstores. So
facing out, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And if Love I can, it. I take a picture of it. So
And we thank you for that.
It's the least I can do. So how best can listeners learn more about you and your world and the new edition of the book?
Everything is under the world of unmarketing. Join us on the Unpodcast, the business show for the fed up. We love doing it. It's a favorite thing to do. So, and the book, available at wherever fine books are sold.
Okay. And the documentary you're working on, Unspeakable, I think it's unspeakablemovie.com.
Yep.
When can people, and you can go there to sign up for announcements and so forth. When is that looking? Sometime next year, 2018?
Yeah, so maybe? It's Unspeakable, the truth about our biggest fear. It's about people's fear of public speaking. And we're in the works. So we have no estimated date, probably about a year and a half or so until it comes out. But we're working on it slowly but surely. We're interviewing at our own schedule. And we've interviewed a bunch of people already and getting some great footage. We're doing some more filming in 2 weeks. So we'll get there. It's a fascinating topic for us and one that I don't have a fear of speaking. So it's always interesting for me to learn more about why people do. And when we're hoping to help some people that have it, that can help them with that fear.
Yeah, I can't wait for it. I know it's going to be great. The name of the book is Unmarketing. Everything has changed and nothing is different. The authors are Scott and Allison Stratton. Scott, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again for having me again.
And that closes the book on episode 101 of the Marketing Book Podcast. My apologies for it not being exactly 59 minutes long, but please don't let the end of this episode be the end of what you can learn about modern marketing. Visit marketingbookpodcast.com for links to all the things we talked about in this interview and free marketing guides from my agency. And while there, make sure to sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And if you're looking for a book recommendation or have a question or a guest suggestion, here's how to get in touch. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and send a message or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Or send me a tweet at my Twitter handle @marketingbook. And please join us next time as we talk with Jason Burby about the book he's co-authored with Shane Atchison entitled, Does It Work? 10 Principles for Delivering True Business Value in Digital Marketing. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.